From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer of California. She's the chief deputy whip and one of the most outspoken senators in the party. Recently, she made headlines with her tough questioning of Condoleezza Rice during Rice's confirmation hearings. Boxer was the only senator to object to the certification of Ohio's electoral votes. We'll talk about the direction of her party and her political style. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the euphemism love child and why we still use that Victoria-era term. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by the Revolutionary Ensemble, which formed in 1971, broke up 6 years later, and then reunited for this new recording. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Senator Barbara Boxer of California, is one of the most outspoken Democrats in the Senate and is now the chief deputy whip. When she was reelected last November, she received more votes than any other candidate in the nation, with the exception of the two presidential candidates. She was first elected to the Senate in 1992, after serving 10 years in the House. Recently, she has opposed the war in Iraq and voted against the confirmation of Justice Department head Alberto Gonzalez and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Now she's fighting against the Bush administration plan to privatize Social Security and opposing efforts to restrict access to abortion. We invited her to talk with us about the direction of the Democratic Party and her own political style. Senator Boxer, welcome to Fresh Air. You've been taking a very vocal role in the Democratic Party now. During the certification of the Electoral College vote, you challenged the Ohio vote. During the confirmation hearings of Condoleezza Rice, you asked very challenging questions. Let me quote something Joanna Newman wrote in the LA Times last month. She wrote, "With liberals dusting themselves off after their November setbacks, California Senator Barbara Boxer has emerged as the left's new flamethrower." What do you think of that that description of you?
It's silly. I was just doing my job. I've done that since the day I got into public life, asking hard questions, trying to hold people accountable for their decisions, trying to hold myself accountable for my decisions. And people have just noticed it.
Do you think that most of the people in the Democratic Party on Capitol Hill are comfortable with how outspoken you are? Do you think that there are many people in the party who wish that you would moderate your voice so that the party could have a more moderate public face?
Well, I don't represent the party. I represent the people of California, and I am a proud Democrat. And believe me, when things are going well and we can work together, I'll be moderating my voice. I'll be smiling more. But when things aren't going right, when people are misleading the American people, I'm going to hold them to account. It's not something that's planned. It's just an honest response to the issues of the day. We are in a fight really for the heart and soul of this country, in my opinion. And we need to get back on track, whether it's getting back on fiscal track, whether it's keeping our promises to older Americans, meaning Social Security, whether it is making sure that people have a quality of life, that their first responders have what they need to do their job, that the children get a good education, that the bill that I wrote with a Republican colleague to give after school to kids is fully funded. These are important issues. And, you know, whether you bring them to the public in one style or another, to me, isn't important. The most important thing is that the people's voice is heard.
One of the things that Harry Reid, the new Senate minority leader, has done is he created a Democratic war room on Capitol Hill. What has that been doing?
This is was really a brainchild of several members who felt that the messages that we're working on are just not getting out to the American people. And so what Harry did, and I think it was a bold move, is to make sure we can reach out to the media in a better way. For example, you mentioned the Condi Rice hearings, and then we had the Gonzalez confirmation debate and vote. It was very important to get out to the media something that we thought they weren't really explaining to the American people, and that is that our job is advice and consent. A lot of people think, well, the president should be able to say who he wants in his cabinet, and that's the end of it. Well, that's not what our founders thought. So we wanted to make sure, make positively sure, that people knew we were doing our work. It's not always easy, but it's important. In the case of Condi Rice, many of us felt, even if those who voted for her, that we did have to discuss the kinds of things she went out and told the American people before the war and continuing after the war, things that were not true. In the case of Gonzalez, we thought it was very important, those who voted for or against him, to lay out on the record his association with a policy on torture that was in effect for really 2 years, which we think led to the abuses at Abu Ghraib. We thought it was important to get that out.
The Republican National Committee issued a 13-page document this week saying that Harry Reid is determined to obstruct President Bush's agenda. What's your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction is really Harry's reaction, because I was on the floor of the Senate when he learned about this. First of all, they attacked his family, which was incredible. And my colleague Dick Durbin, who doesn't mince words, said something like, the hottest place in hell is reserved for those who attack a politician's family. It was a low thing to do. And Harry pointed out, with all the problems we have, the deepest deficits in history, even with all these terrible cuts, the deepest deficits, deepest debt. Every child born's got about a $36,000 debt on his or her back. I call it a birth tax. We've got no exit strategy from Iraq. We still have people who are losing their health care. And now we have people scared they're going to lose their Social Security. With all these issues, they turn on Harry Reid and try to attack him. And I think he basically said, this isn't what the American people want.
The general wisdom seems to be that one of the reasons why the Republicans won the presidential election is the evangelical vote. Jim Wallace, who is a liberal evangelical, has a book that's on the bestseller list called God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. And by the left doesn't get it, he means that he thinks that the left is too secular and that they need to address religious values in a more direct and compelling way, as opposed to being as secular as he believes they sound now. I know that he also addressed many Democrats on Capitol Hill. I'm wondering your reaction to his argument.
I met him and I heard him speak, and he's really smart. And I think it is true that we in the Democratic Party, regardless of whether we're progressive or moderate or more conservative, we should be very willing to talk about our spirituality. I certainly have no problem with it. When I made my speech against drilling in Anwar, the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, I call it God's gift. And I quoted a rabbi who wrote 1,500 years ago that we better be careful what we do with the land that we've been given by God, because if we ruin it, there won't be anyone to repair it. So I think it's true that sometimes we want to keep our spirituality private. And I think if we feel comfortable referring to it, I think that's fine. If we don't, that's fine too with me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Barbara Boxer, Democratic Senator from California. The new leader of the Democratic National Committee is almost certainly going to be Howard Dean. He's generally regarded as being on the left side of the party. Let me read something that David Brooks, the conservative columnist, wrote in the New York Times. He said, "Many Republicans are mystified as to why the Democrats, having lost another election, are about to name Howard Dean as party chairman and have allowed Barbara Boxer and Ted Kennedy to emerge unchallenged as the loudest foreign policy voices. The answer, as Mickey Kaus observes in Slate, is that the party is following the money. The energy and the dough are in the MoveOn.org wing, which is not even a wing of the party, but the head and the wallet. Only the most passionate and liberal voices can stir up this network of online donors from the educated class." What do you think about that? Do you think that MoveOn and funding issues are behind the choice of Howard Dean?
I can't say why people voted for Howard Dean, because I'm not in the organization, the DNC. They decided, after looking over everybody, that he was the one who probably, and I don't know this for sure, probably had the most organized plan for the Democratic Party. I just knowing him as I do, and I think it must have gotten them very excited. But I have to say that to say that Ted Kennedy and Barbara Boxer are suddenly speaking out against the war because we know that it's going to bring in dollars is so ridiculous. It's insane. The fact of the matter is Ted Kennedy and Barbara Boxer and Carl Levin and Paul Sarbanes and a number of others of us, Robert Byrd, for an example, who is not considered in the liberal wing of the party, really, just very much against this war. We've been consistently saying that we went into war on false pretenses, There was no plan for an exit strategy. We're worried about our men and women in uniform. We want to make sure that they come home as soon as possible, leaving behind a stable Iraq. That's what we've been saying for a long time. We're not saying that because, you know, we want people to send checks. We're saying it because we want our young men and women to be able to come home as soon as possible, safe and sound. And that's really where it's at.
You are very opposed to the invasion of Iraq. Has the outcome of the vote affected your view of what America did there?
No. I am very happy at the vote because I think it shows that the Iraqi people really do have the courage to stand up to these insurgents in their own way. But to me, we could have done the same thing without losing 1,400 plus of our beautiful people and wounding 11,000 had we kept on what we were doing, which is to work with the world to keep pressure on Hussein. He couldn't have withstood it. Intrusive inspections, we could have done this, just as we did with Milosevic. We used some of our military in terms of air power, but we nabbed him. We could have done that this way. So no, I think we could have brought this about in a much better way. We now have a breeding ground of terror there. The new estimates of the insurgency are climbing. There are some estimates from Iraqi intelligence that there's as many as 200,000 supporters of the insurgents. So this is a very costly, complicated situation. And I think we could have seen a better result and brought democracy to those folks in a way that didn't have such terrible human cost and, by the way, dollar costs at a time when we are now slashing and burning, you know, so many programs important to people. Not me, but this president. You know, he's got an open checkbook for Iraq with absolutely no end in sight.
My guest is Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer of California. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barbara Boxer, Democratic Senator from California. Now, one of the biggest issues that you'll be facing on Capitol Hill is the future of Social Security. I understand that you have a memo, a paper, that you want to introduce into Senate discussion. Tell us what you plan to do.
There are two papers that I want to introduce into Senate discussion. One of them is a White House memo that was leaked and has a very clear statement. And that clear statement is that for six decades, they've been trying to get rid of Social Security, and finally they have their opportunity. And I can give you the exact quote. I have it in front of me. This was written January 3rd, 2005, by one of Karl Rove's assistants. "For the first time in six decades," he writes, "the Social Security battle is one we can win." Now, let's just analyze that. That's 60 years. So it's right out there. For 60 years, they've been trying to do away with Social Security. And then the other document is a 1983 paper that was put out by a very right-wing think tank, and it was called Achieving a Leninist Strategy. And they talk about the strategy that this tyrant communist Lenin used to overturn capitalism. And this is one of the quotes in there. "Unlike many other socialists at the time, Lenin recognized that fundamental change is contingent both upon a movement's ability to create a focused political coalition and upon its success in isolating and weakening its opponents." And in that paper, it essentially says you have to buy off the people who were older, tell them they're going to be okay. And essentially, everything they suggest the president is doing. For example, this is what they said. the sine qua non of any successful Social Security reform strategy must be an assurance to those already retired or nearing retirement that their benefits will be paid in full. By accepting this principle, we may succeed in neutralizing the most powerful element of the coalition that opposes structural reform. Now, that was written in 1983 by this right-wing think tank. Here's George Bush, February 2nd, 05, State of the Union. I have a message for every American who is 55 or older. Do not let anyone mislead you. For you, the Social Security system will not change in any way. So there's a blueprint out there, and the blueprint is clear, and this administration is carrying it out. And it's a tragedy for the people of this country.
In a way, it's not a surprise that there would have been a paper like this in 1983, because a lot of conservatives have never really liked federal funding, particularly of programs that have been called entitlements, including Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. So what do you find shocking about this? I mean, and it's one memo.
I find it very shocking that these right-wingers, who are supposed to hate communism, lay out a strategy to emulate Lenin and say exactly how the president, they didn't know George Bush would be the one, should carry this out. In it, they call for building a powerful, well-financed coalition. That coalition should consist not only of those who will reap the benefits from the private system, but banks, insurance companies, and other institutions. And what do we see happening now? We see and this is a quote from the Wall Street Journal, from an article called "To Get Backing for Overhaul, $35 Million Effort Begins." The administration's careful planning of the pro-overhaul lobbying effort, its messages and scope are being coordinated by White House political guru Karl Rove. Now, why should people be shocked? Because here's the president coming to them via the State of the Union address, one of the most important speeches that a president gives, and telling them Social Security is in crisis. It's on the verge of collapse. He used the word bankruptcy several times. And he's trying to tell the people that this is why they have to essentially end the system, when in fact, this has been the right wing's plan for 6 decades. This is not about a crisis. So I find it really shocking that the president would put that out to the people, that he's acting because there's a crisis. By the way, in 1978, President Bush, then candidate for Congress, said Social Security is going bankrupt by 1988 if we don't do private accounts. He was wrong then. He is wrong now. He is doing this because he is so ideological. He runs the Senate, he runs the House, and he runs the White House. So this is the moment that these people who wrote about using a Leninist strategy have been waiting for. And I do find it really shocking that the right wing would be embracing Lenin.
So what do you hope the outcome will be when you bring up these two memos in the Senate? What do you expect
Oh, I have no idea what the repercussions will be, but it's going to become part of the debate. These documents will become part of the debate. Now, they've been exposed in the press already, so it's not as if I'm doing something completely original. But I think it really is an expose of their real intent here. When you see a document that's written just a month ago that says we've been waiting for this day for 6 decades, when you read the right-wing think tanks, listen, you don't even have to go that far. On, I believe it was NPR. It could have been on your show. I don't know. They had Grover Norquist, and Senator Reid was saying that Grover Norquist said, look, Social Security is not really in crisis. It's just a lousy system. We want to get rid of it. Well, that's the most honest statement I've heard. But the president is letting the people think that he's, quote unquote, saving Social Security, when in fact they just want to do away with it. And the thing I would say to folks 55 and older, you are not off the hook. Because imagine a two-tier system where everyone under that age gets a way worse system. And a future president, say 8-10 years from now, when faced with the borrowing that has to go on to save the system. The future president is going to say, you know, I can't do this for 20% of the population. What about 80% that isn't going to get this rich system? So no one is protected here.
By the way, that report with Grover Norquist that you mentioned, I think that one was on Morning Edition. He's been on our show, but I think the comment that you made was from Morning Edition.
Okay.
Just
let the record be clear.
Let the record be clear, exactly. So when do you plan on introducing these two documents?
I am planning to make a statement on the floor next week with the women. You know, the Democratic women have organized under the leadership of Barbara Mikulski, and each of us is taking kind of a different approach to the president's plan. And as part of my statement next week, I'm going to talk about these two documents, but I'm also going to hold a press conference at home later this week if I get home from Washington in time in California to let the folks know what I'm doing on this.
Senator Barbara Boxer will be back in the second half of the show. We invited the authors of the 1983 article on Social Security that Barbara Boxer was discussing. We invited them to talk with us. One of the authors declined. The other was unavailable to talk with us before today's broadcast. We're planning a program on the Social Security debate, which we expect to broadcast next week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, featuring the AARP Crash Course in Estate Planning, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease, on the web at alz.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer looks back on her 12 years in the Senate. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the euphemisms we use and don't use for having a child out of wedlock. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by the Reunited Revolutionary Ensemble. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer of California. She's the chief deputy whip and is one of the most outspoken senators in her party. She was elected to the Senate in 1992 after serving 10 years in the House. Senator Boxer, you were in the House for 10 years. You've been in the Senate for 12 years. Can you compare a little bit the two experiences from your point of view, the difference between being in the House and being in the Senate?
There's such a difference, and people don't really get it. When you're in the House, the obvious thing to tell you is you're one of 435 people. The majority party has ultimate power. Ultimate power. That's the way the rules go. And they were drawn up that way because it would be, they figured, unwieldy. So that when you're in the minority in the House, it's very difficult to have an effective voice. you can use your platform, but you don't get too many things done as you would want to. In the Senate, as long as the minority party has more than 41, 42 seats, you have tremendous influence there. So a Republican or a Democrat, majority or minority, you have a lot of power. Individual senators can hold up business. Individual senators can disagree to unanimous consent requests, so you can have leverage on the business in the Senate. It's very interesting because, particularly as a woman, people often ask, is it really a men's club? Well, the interesting thing is that in the Senate, because each senator is so powerful in the sense of your prerogatives and your ability to exert pressure on that body, using all the tools at your disposal, it's really an institution where you're pretty much equal to everybody else. In the House, where it's more based on seniority, it's much tougher. And there, the women had less power because you had to wait till you were there 20 years or get elected leader of the Democrats, like my wonderful friend Nancy Pelosi has done, and she's so good at it.
Now, you joined the Senate in 1992, which was called the Year of the Woman. Why was it called that?
It was called the Year of the Woman because it was the time when Clarence Thomas had come before the United States Senate Judiciary Committee. Anita Hill had made her accusations. And at first, the Senate didn't want to take time out to even look at those allegations. And as you may remember, some of your listeners might, I was one of the congresswomen walking over. It was with Pat Schroeder and Patsy Mink and several others. We walked over to the Senate and we said, please, you need to give this woman her day to explain what happened. And we fought for a hearing. They did, in fact, hold a hearing. But during that hearing, people in the country saw there wasn't one woman on the Senate Judiciary Committee. It was shocking to people. They never realized it. I mean, they kind of knew it, but they saw it. And I think they opened up their eyes and said, you know, we need a few women in the Senate. Well, I always thought it was an exaggeration to call it the Year of the Woman. We went from 2 to 6. We tripled the numbers, but there was a long way to go. Now we're up to 14.
You know, you mentioned how you and 6 other congressmen went to the Senate and demanded that Anita Hill be given a chance to make her charges against Clarence Thomas before his confirmation. What reaction did you get from the senators?
Oh, let's just say they weren't too happy to see us. We climbed up the stairs. I think there were about 10 of us. I can't remember. Congresswomen. And between us, we must have had an average of, you know, 130 years in the Congress. And we walked up, we knocked on the door, and they basically said, you can't come in. The Democratic senators were having lunch. Now, ironically, of course, I'm in that room every Tuesday. And they said, we don't let strangers in. And I was shocked, and I didn't realize that strangers was a term of art that meant anyone who's not a senator. And I thought they were calling us, you know, strangers in the larger sense. I said, well, we're not strangers. We're Democratic elected congresswomen. We have all this experience. Well, they wouldn't let us in, but George Mitchell, who was the majority leader at the time, did agree to see us privately, and he did. And I have to give him tremendous credit. He did make sure that there was a hearing held.
Do you think that the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings were really a galvanizing experience for both the left and the right?
Well, I don't really look at things as left and right, as you seem to. I really don't. I see it as a galvanizing experience for Americans, regardless of their political point of view. I think they saw, regardless of how they felt about Clarence Thomas, that there were no women sitting on these committees, and Republicans began to elect women. You know, when Senator Feinstein and I were elected at the same time, the same year, the first two women ever elected from any state. We then had Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins. We have since had from Maine and from Washington State, Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray. So, and we've had more Republican women elected. Well, Susan and Olympia are Republicans. So I think it was very galvanizing in terms of the lack of women and people seeing that.
Does sisterhood amount to much in the Senate when somebody is in the opposing party? In other words, the fact that you are a woman and, say, Kay Bailey Hutchinson is a woman and her politics are very different than yours, does that give you any kind of bond?
Yes, there is a bond, absolutely, at this stage of our history. But that doesn't mean, you know, we don't disagree. We disagree a lot. You picked an individual with whom I've had many a battle on the respectful battle on the Senate floor about drilling offshore for oil and versus protecting the environment and oil royalties that I fought to have them pay to the states and so they can go into the classroom, and she's tried to reduce it because she's representing her constituents. So from Texas, but there is a bond under it all, yes. And as a matter of fact, Barbara Mikulski and Kay Bailey Hutchison work together so that all the women try to have dinner once a month on Capitol Hill, regardless of party. And that's pretty unusual around here.
My guest is Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer of California. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer of California. You know, we've talked a little bit about what it's been like to be a woman in the House and in the Senate during a transitional time in American politics in terms of women's roles. What was the role of the women's movement on your life?
It was huge because I moved to California in 1965. I was 25 years old, and I was... I had my first child that year, my second child in 2 years later. So I was a young mother when the women's movement really started to hit, along with the environmental movement and the peace movement. I mean, this was all at that time. Because I was a young mother, I was extremely concerned about the world that my kids were going to grow up in. And I was concerned for peace in the world, and I've stayed that way forever, and I was concerned that my daughter would have the ability to do whatever she wanted and follow her dreams. So, and of course, the obvious, I wanted them to be able to breathe clean air and all the rest. So I got very involved in these issues at a very early stage, and it led me step by step into politics for a little while, into journalism. And the women's movement really, I think, spoke to the women of my age group who were having families and said, you know, if you want, you can still be active in issues and in life and in work. It's okay. And that was important.
How have American politics changed since you entered politics?
When I ran for my first office, it was 1972. It was a local county supervisor seat. It was, at that time, a part-time job, the incumbent who held it. And I challenged that incumbent, and I came very close to winning. I actually lost something like 11,000 to 10,000. The letters to the editor against me had nothing to do with my views on the issue. This was a nonpartisan race. It was that I had young children. My children were young, and how dare I do this? It was, and I had people, when I went door-to-door, say that. Now, I explained to them that my opponent was a man, that he had a full-time job, he had two kids as well, and his wife worked. But that didn't seem to matter to people back then. They said, well, we know that, but you know, we're worried about your children. And so I honestly do believe in those years, without question, there was prejudice. There were more people who were willing to vote against you simply because you're a woman than there were willing to vote for you. And it just was a very painful experience that I've written about. Things have changed enormously now. And I really don't know many women today who face that type of prejudice.
I guess one example of how things are changed were the Condoleezza Rice confirmation hearings.
Definitely.
She's being confirmed for Secretary of State, and you, a Democratic senator, are asking her very challenging questions about her record. And it seems like on either end, it really has nothing to do with being a woman. Not to deny that you're women, but what's at issue isn't the fact that you're women.
Exactly. And how proud am I of that? The fact is, these are very, very tough questions. It was interesting because, you know, there were three women involved. We had Senator Feinstein, who introduced her to the committee. You had Dr. Rice, now Secretary Rice. And you had me as sort of major players in this little drama that became a drama when all it was doing, each of us were doing our job. But somebody said to me afterwards, some media person, well, didn't you feel terrible giving such tough questions to Dr. Rice, who is a minority woman? And I said, it would be so condescending for me not to question her the way I did. It would show a lack of respect for her work and what she's done and her record. And I absolutely agree that it was a breakthrough moment. I think you're the first person who's ever made that point, but I think it was a breakthrough moment for women.
Now, I understand you got off of jury duty in order to prepare for the Condoleezza Rice hearings. And there's whenever you're on, this is my experience anyways, when you're called for jury duty, there's a point in which the judge says, is there anybody for whom serving in this jury would be a very compromising situation? Compromising isn't the word they use, but they make it sound like it needs to be life and death. So how did you explain to the judge that you really needed to study mm-hmm. for these hearings? what did you say?
Well, she didn't make it life and death. She just said, is there anybody here who has a problem being at an 11-day trial, which it was. So it would have taken me not only the preparation, but into, I would have missed the hearing. Wouldn't that have been nice for Dr. Rice? I simply waited in line. We had a huge group of prospective jurors. There were about 50 of us who had our reasons, and I was in the back of the room, so I heard most of them, which were, I own my own business, and it'd be a hardship, and, you know, I'm ill, and I have to go to the doctor, and I have a trip, and I have the tickets here to prove it, and they were, because that was something she said, if you had a non-refundable airline ticket. So when it came to me, I just stood up and I said, Your Honor, it's a privilege to be in your court. But I have to say, you have to say, by the way, who you are and who you work for. And I said, I'm Barbara Boxer, and I work for the people of California as their senator. And I have to prepare for questioning Dr. Condoleezza Rice. It's a very important hearing, and that I would miss the actual hearing because of the 11-day trial. And the judge said, thank you for all you do for our state. Isn't that nice?
Yeah. Now, are they going to give you an alternate date?
Oh, Terry, I hope not. I hope not. I. It's so difficult. But, I mean, it would be so that was a very interesting a trial there. They explained a little bit of it. But it's just very difficult when you do this work to be able to take time, unless it's on a break, you know, and you
right.
have a
no,
solid
I understand.
Week.
I understand. Well, Senator Boxer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Barbara Boxer is a Democratic senator from California. In 1971, violinist Leroy Jenkins, bassist Cerrone, and drummer Jerome Cooper formed a singular group known as the Revolutionary Ensemble. They broke up 6 years and a handful of albums later. Last year, the band reunited to make a new CD. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's like they'd barely been away. We'll be right back.
The Revolutionary Ensemble was one of the great jazz bands of the 1970s. The trio almost epitomized that much maligned era in jazz. It was a time of rethinking the available possibilities, when new instrumental combinations and new ways of sorting out ensemble roles became common. The 70s avant-garde often had a lighter touch than the 60s version, not so loud and bashing. Here was a band with a proud backwoods violin out front, given plenty of elbow room by bass and drums. That makes for an airy texture. Violinist Leroy Jenkins came up in the Chicago Collective, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, where colleagues like Leo Smith and the Art Ensemble of Chicago valued silence as a counterbalance to sound. It's remarkable how easily this group picks up where it left off a quarter century ago. Their new CD is And Now, the Revolutionary Ensemble, on the Pi label. Since these players parted ways, Leroy Jenkins has become a force in contemporary music, collaborating with dancer Bill T. Jones and writer Greg Tate, among others. Drummer Jerome Cooper has played inventive solo concerts, accompanying himself with pre-programmed electronics he triggers live. Cooper also saw the Twin Towers collapse from an East Village rooftop. On his long elegiac suite 911-544, Cooper blows his Mexican folk oboe, the chirimia, while drumming with his feet. Bassist Cerrone is as handy with a bow as the violinist is, which helps the blend. But he knows better than to crowd Leroy Jenkins, given the fiddler's expressive sense of pitch. Let the man breathe. Cerrone has been working out of Berlin and Vienna for years, and he brought the catchiest tunes back to the band, including Ism Schism, whose theme sounds like something Mozart's parents danced to. The band wisely treat it with that breezy detachment that's central to their charm. Great to have him back.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. Coming up, as we near Valentine's Day, our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about some of the ways we use the word love. This is Fresh Air. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about some of the ways we use the word love, as in love child, love nest, lover. He says there's something about the word love that makes it irresistible to the media when they want to inject a salacious note into a headline. Jeff points out that times may have changed, but when it comes to language, Victorian euphemisms still reign.
When it came out recently that Denny Farrell, the chairman of the New York Democratic Party, was about to have a baby with his longtime partner, the New York Post reported the story in true tabloid style. "Farrell has fathered an out-of-wedlock love child," it proclaimed a bit redundantly. Farrell was enraged, and not least by the wording. "It makes it look like a major sin," he said. "We're living in the 21st century." Farrell's response provoked predictable indignation from the cultural right. A columnist at National Review commented sarcastically that Farrell's remark was a perfect encapsulation of the modern mindset. And an evangelical blogger noted that when last he looked, bearing a child out of wedlock was still a sin. But even if you want to defend Victorian moral values, it's odd that we're still using Victorian language to describe them. And particularly an item like love child, which the Victorians used as a sentimental euphemism for bastard in an age when the illegitimate had neither legal rights nor social identities. Even at the time, the phrase was considered a bit fulsome. Dickens thought that it disguised the pain of being illegitimate. As he put it, love child means anything but a child of love. And some worried that the phrase was actually contributing to a moral decline by casting a romantic veil over illegitimacy. As one clergyman put it, "It would be hard to estimate how much the substitution of love child for bastard has lowered the tone and standard of morality among us, or for how many young women it may have helped to make the downward way more sloping still." But nowadays, it's hard to find anybody who will stand up for bastard. There are still lots of people who consider it sinful for unmarried people to have a baby, but linguistically at least, we try to refrain from visiting the sin on the offspring. That's why we no longer use bastard in its original meaning unless we're speaking metaphorically, as in arena football is the bastard child of the NFL. For us, bastard is merely an epithet for a disagreeable person. Something like son of a bitch, which could also imply a dubious birth, back when bitch suggested promiscuity rather than mere nastiness. "If you want to call me that, smile," Gary Cooper said famously in the 1929 movie The Virginian, but nowadays people are a little vague on what you were supposed to be smiling about. Once people stopped using bastard in a literal way, they no longer needed most of the euphemisms for the word. We still describe things as misbegotten, but we don't associate that word with illegitimacy anymore. But journalists still cling tenaciously to love child, as if bastardy were still something that has to be danced around. For some people, love child has simply inherited the taint of bastard. Love child, the Supremes sang, never quite as good, afraid, ashamed, misunderstood. But when you see it in the media, love child suggests not so much shame as titillation and scandal, particularly in high places. It's only the rich and famous that the press describes as having a love child. Ordinary folks have to content themselves with having children out of wedlock. But then, euphemisms that contain love often have a suggestive or lurid cast that makes them too delicious for the press to abandon, even when time has passed them by. When it came out that Bernard Kerik was using a police department apartment in downtown Manhattan for assignations with his girlfriends, reporters were quick to talk about his love nest, a phrase that by all rights should have expired at the same time Prohibition did. Or then there's simply lover. When you see a headline with a reference to so-and-so's lover, you can usually assume that there's something sensationalistic or lurid afoot. Officer says he didn't shoot lover. Peterson's ex-lover testifies. So I was looking forward to a juicy read when I saw the headline in the San Francisco Chronicle not long ago, "University of California creates $192,000 post for Santa Cruz Chief's lesbian lover." But the story itself was a letdown. It turned out that the lesbian lover in question was actually the longtime partner of the newly hired chancellor at UC Santa Cruz, and was herself a well-respected professor of engineering at the University of Washington. That might be a potential administrative scandal, but it was a singularly unsalacious one. When I asked a friend at the Chronicle about the use of lover in that headline, she pointed out that gays and lesbians sometimes do refer to their domestic partners as lovers. "That's true," I said, "but not with the adjective. I want you to meet my lesbian lover, Jane." Since time immemorial, there's been no word like love to evoke a wink and a nudge. It isn't just journalists who know that. You think of all the phrases beginning with love that softcore pornographers use to delineate the sexual anatomy, always prefaced by throbbing or churning, and somehow more lascivious than the words they euphemize. Or for that matter, recall how Johnny Carson always got a laugh when he worked an item like love-starved or love-hostess into a routine. If Victorian morality still has a hold on us, it has a lot to do with our reluctance to give up the delight we take in clucking our tongues.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and the author of Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. We're closing with music by Jimmy Smith. He played the Hammond organ and popularized the use of that instrument in jazz. He died Tuesday at the age of 76. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to improving the quality of health care for all Americans by working to reduce ethnic and racial disparities in care, and from TIAA Cref, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Why does time appear to march forward? Is space empty? Is science in conflict with religion? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with physicist Brian Greene, author of the best-selling book, The Fabric of the Cosmos, which was just published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.